is here today, and she's from the Juvenile Project.
I'm OPDS, and I'm the new Deputy General Counsel. I'll be working on juvenile law issues, and I'm here to watch and learn.
Okay, so you got the position.
I did. I feel very fortunate.
Okay. Hope you'll still say that a year from now. Let's go around and we can introduce ourselves for Amy. I'm Judge Sullivan. We could just go that way.
Leola McKenzie.
Judge Law.
Angela Sherbo.
Lori Fellows.
Joanne Southey.
Lene Garrett.
I'm Bill Taylor.
Okay. We our agenda today is pretty simple. We're going to work on the reports from each of the work groups that we had. And we've got, you should have the strategies to address barriers for permanency. And then we've got three more, I think.
There are three altogether.
Yeah, and we're going to pass those out so everybody has one. Okay, what I thought we could do today is go through each one of these. I think every group took the idea that they went through everything that we had before and put it all where they thought it belonged without a lot of discretion or editing to take out things. And so if there are things that, and there are obviously duplication within each of these areas, and things that we may want to eliminate because they don't reach sufficient priority that we want to present them to the legislature. And there may be things that got left out. So what I'd like to do to start is, if it's agreeable to the rest of the group, is to go through each one of these, and especially since you may not have had a chance to read them, and talk about them in that sense, and then we can try to edit down and figure out what form we want to present this in. And especially if we're going to recommend legislation, we have to get busy on that because we have a September 15th deadline. So we need to look at what might require a legislative change and decide if we want to propose legislation. So is there someone from the strategies to address barriers for permanency court and docketing that wants to start with that one? That was, I don't remember who was who.
That was us.
Okay.
Do we want to start, do we want to go through it, or do we want to have people, has everybody had a chance to review it? It was sent by Leola, I thought.
It was sent actually quite a while ago.
Quite a while ago.
The first
ago.
One that went out.
So.
Okay, well this one is actually broken up into the areas. And then you might go to page where it says B, because the they've got in B and C and D, they broke it up on things, and there are some recommendations for
do you want me to walk through since ours, and then we can kind of have discussion back and forth,
right.
So we can start reading things out.
I shouldn't want to read to everybody if they've already read it, you know, and if there are any particular issues that come up.
Okay.
So do you want to go
so maybe we
A?
Just start with A.
Okay.
And if people have, maybe look at your specific entity. What we did is we just took everything that we could find from a couple of different of the previous list, and we put them all in. And I certainly don't think that everything that's listed under court strategies would be something that mm-hmm. our judges would say all of these things can happen without existing resources right now. Mm-hmm. And I think the A list, the cooperative action plan, was those things. What can you do now without existing resources? So
one thing that I noticed in that one is the first one, you have the appoint attorneys prior to shelter hearing. I think that's in all three of these. So that's emerged, I think, as a something that's just really bubbled right to the top. It's the first one mm-hmm. on the one that I did. And that is something that there are two parts of that. One is appointing attorneys for shelter care hearings at all, and then that they need to be appointed before the hearing. So there's really two parts to that, because there are some courts that appoint them at the hearing. There are some that appoint before, and I think we did a survey, if you all remember, that a majority of them are appointing them for the shelter care, but there are still significant counties in terms of volume that are not. And then how you facilitate that in terms of the attorney being able to meaningfully appear. And what most counties are using is allowing for a continued hearing or a second hearing so that the attorneys can be comfortable that they can represent somebody adequately when they have only met them for, only known them for an hour, and they don't have discovery and things like that. So I think that one, in terms of that one, is something that we need to kind of maybe put a star or a circle around, because I think that's going to be one that we really have decided to focus on.
I want to make sure that we want to move quickly. There's small things that I have objections to. I don't want to waste the group's time, but I don't want us to assume that if we get to the end of it that there's a consensus. Does that seem like a reasonable way to go? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and see, some of these, again, the groups didn't edit particularly, so there may be things that we really don't want to, they're good things and stuff, but they're not something that we want to do much with, other than maybe mentioned before.
Well, I'll just say what it is, because it shows up on two of them, and I think it's a very minor point. But representing kids, I know that although many of us think it's a great idea for judges to see who it is that they're talking about, many, many youth and children absolutely object to having their photographs in a court file that, you know, exists into perpetuity. And so while that seems small, I think mm-hmm. it's controversial, and I don't want to be seen as agreeing to it. I think it's a privacy question, and as we begin looking at the changes in the records statute, it's even more problematic.
Although I will say, often in Multnomah County, a worker will show the judge the picture mm-hmm. and take it.
I do that myself, yes.
And not have it entered into evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think something to address, actually having that visual of that child rather than just a report, and because our cases, we don't see kids come in that often.
Right.
So just some way to have that face and get a sense of...
See, I'm a big proponent that the kids, you should see the kids. But obviously, there are going to be situations where they can't come or for whatever reason, but I want to see them at some point. But I agree, maybe on the picture one, we indicate that it shouldn't be retained in the file.
It should be shown to the...
Right.
Which may raise something, because sometimes those photos are in the CASA's report, uh-huh. too. They'll put the photo in, at least in our county.
Get that a lot.
It'll be included within the body of the text. And so if that's an issue, that might be one we want to discuss a little bit.
Well, maybe we ought to change that to include something that I don't think the CASA's realize that stuff is retained for all time. That's part of the training issues, because they put all kinds of things in there that I don't know that if they really understood that.
It's common practice that CASAs include a picture, and perhaps the court report is not the best place, but just to have it available.
Right.
Because so, you're right, we would not have been aware that there was a reason not to include that as part of discovery or as part of their report.
You know, as a judge, I love seeing the pictures, even if it's a kid I'm seeing an awful lot. Just, mm-hmm. And I have kids come and give me pictures, you know, years later. People give me pictures of kids. But you're right.
I know in our county, if it's a child of an age that can say yes or no, I want the judge to see my picture, our CASAs are taught to ask that of the child. And sometimes we actually ask the parents because the parents appreciate seeing the picture of their child. So I think we've tried to cover that base, but at the same time, it's a practice that we probably should revisit.
I think it's, I appreciate that point, though, so that we can be aware of the fact that they may not want that in there.
So I think we can retain that, you know, it's a good thing to do the pictures, but they shouldn't be entered in the record. And then that, you know.
Can we change require to encourage?
Just take and submit with case materials out.
Yeah.
Very good point.
Let's see. I guess I could ask, you know, if we go to the second page of the court strategy, some of these I think we have talked about quite a bit, mm-hmm. making sure we do things in a timely manner and whatnot. The do not delay jurisdiction due to criminal proceedings, that also is in B for drafting legislation.
I think that has some significant issues for the parents and for their Fifth Amendment rights. The criminal attorneys will go crazy about that from the standpoint that, first of all, the DAs are not going to want to, or the AGs aren't going to want to try a dependency petition, for example, on a homicide case, if you've got a criminal case pending, because there's some issues about the discovery that the defense could be getting. If there are children that are victims, they're going to have to testify twice. I mean, there are just some real pitfalls with that. In addition to that, you've got parents that have an absolute Fifth Amendment right not to talk about things, and if the court's ordering services that are going to require them to talk about the incident, parents aren't going to do that. And I have trouble seeing the Court of Appeals is going to allow a change in permanent plan when a parent's had an absolute constitutional right not to talk about those issues and they've exercised that right. So I think there are just some real pitfalls with that approach.
We were talking about this briefly. I mean, I totally recognize that. There is an appellate case on point that says the juvenile court shall not wait while a criminal case is pending, and regardless of that Fifth Amendment right, they don't have to testify at the juvenile hearing. Now, I get that if that's the only issue in the case and that's where the services will be focused, then that would be a problem. Oftentimes, it's a combination of things.
They're in jail pre-trial on a homicide.
And
we often just say that. Well, they're in jail and unavailable to parent.
Yeah, right. That's typically how we resolve those jurisdictionally.
It's in Multnomah, yes. I think when you get out of Multnomah, it's
they're not
really,
in jail pending trial on homicides?
I mean, I don't mean the jail part.
Right.
What I mean is that there is an inherent conflict at times when the DA is standing in a juvenile court in a very small DA's office and they also handle the criminal case and they say, we're not going forward on the juvenile case because my deskmate next to me doesn't want me to. And then, you know, it's tricky then. Does the DHS get their own attorneys to come in? And then the AG's office doesn't want to come in and step on toes and doesn't want to come in and harm that criminal case in any way. So it's kind of sometimes there is a balance that you can do to say, well, you say they're in jail and unavailable, or you attack other issues that are also at risk, placing the child at risk if there was drug and alcohol or something else besides the criminal conduct, and focus on that and then add the criminal later if that's available. But I think that, and I can find that appellate case for you all, but that's certainly our intent, is that you have to look at the needs of the child and you don't wait for 2 years while a case just winds its way through the criminal with set over after set over when the children are just sitting there waiting with no end in sight. And that happens on a case where you've got one parent with a criminal case like that and another parent who's not involved in the criminal. So
what I've seen happen is, and again, I'm in a small county where they do the same thing, is they'll take jurisdiction based on the parent being in custody and can't, or all the other allegations and then set the contested hearing on the other one to run with the criminal. And so what that results in is that you can do planning and provide services for the kids, but you can't, the case isn't resolved. And so the result of that is that you can't go forward to terminate or something like that. And so it screws up these timelines. The children are safe and you can provide services. So I'm wondering if this is a, are there counties where they're simply not going forward at all on the case? That's the problem. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Is this a legal issue or a training issue, or what's the best way to attack this problem?
And I think, you know, it could be a training issue, because there's obviously case law out there that's relevant that DAs could be arguing. But if it's the same DA that doesn't want to go forward because it's in their office, that's, you know, a different piece. And there are the intergovernmental agreements that the DAs, that the counties enter into with DHS on appearing in juvenile cases, discuss if there's a conflict, what the process would be to base, you know, you identify what the conflict is. Like, we have this criminal case and we don't want to go forward in any manner on this case. Then DHS can staff it with their attorney, and their attorney can then communicate with the DA, figure out if there's a middle ground, or are there ways to go forward on other allegations. So it could be a training issue. I think it was proposed as a statutory fix.
Well, what I've seen that's been more of a problem is that you want to do evaluations, you want to offer services that include counseling, and the defense attorney is saying, no, you can't do any of those things because you might incriminate yourself in the pending criminal. And so the parent isn't able to, and then the parent ends up with a finding that they didn't make sufficient progress and all that kind of stuff, because we took jurisdiction, so we're having the regular reviews. And the fact that they've been told, you know, I think things are better than that. I mean, I used to get that in everything, even stuff that didn't matter. And I'd say, you know, how is it going to prejudice them in any way to get into drug and alcohol treatment? It's not. But the attorneys would say, no, I don't want them to be used against them in the criminal case and stuff like that. And I'm not seeing that as much. But the it seems to me like that's kind of the heart of the problem. You're setting the parent up for a finding that they haven't made sufficient progress because they've been told by their criminal attorney not to do various things that a parent that didn't have criminal charges would be doing.
So my one thought that occurred to me is that, I mean, there are two issues. There the issue of whether or not the petition is being prosecuted, and then the other issue of whether or not the parent is participating. It seems to me that whether or not the parent is participating or has participated to a sufficient degree and the reasons mm-hmm. for that can be litigated at a later time. But mm-hmm. if the first problem is the lack of prosecution of the initial petition, it seems to me like the best place to address that is actually performance standards as opposed to legislation. And I think that this is a theme that occurred to me as I reviewed this, that one of the problems I think we have is the absolute lack of standards for the prosecution, and we have those for defense. We have those for, you know, for parents and for children, and I really think we have one of the products that should come out of this is a requirement that the prosecution also have standards, because that is one of the reasons there is so much variation around the state. Mm-hmm. And so I recognize that that district attorneys may play a different role than DOJ, and so whether or not those standards need to be specific to each, it may well be a fair question, but it doesn't seem like it should be a barrier to creating standards. Either create separate standards for each, or come together and create standards that everyone can agree on, but that, then, there's a training component that can be used to advance and achieve consistency across the state.
And then that becomes interesting, because in our county, we have the DOJ, period. The DA's office isn't involved anymore, and I would assume they're consulting with the DA's office, but we don't run into people requesting postponements mm-hmm. because there's a pending criminal case. And, you know, a pending criminal case can cover so much, usually they figure out a way to resolve it so you're not having to have witnesses come in multiple times and those types of things you're talking about. And so I guess...
I mean, the vast majority of them are not actually directly related to the juvenile. They're not because it's a child homicide and it's going to take 2 years. It's some piddly drug charge that the guy's fighting and has a trial 3 months out and they don't want to admit because they have some idea that that's somehow going to impact the case when it doesn't probably.
So maybe it's figuring out kind of the performance standards or some more guidance on kind of what is going to be good cause if you want to postpone in those circumstances, not just...
And for judges, too, because right. You get some judges that just say, well, there's a criminal case, so we're not going to do anything. And I think that's a problem, too.
Viola, would it be possible with the statistics you all gather about how quickly something goes to jurisdiction and this and that to identify the universe of beyond the 60-day cases and then further identify those that are delayed because of criminal matters and where they are?
I bet that would show something.
Because that might really help us inform our conversation and figure out what exactly is happening.
Unfortunately, through our case management system right now of just writing a query and figuring out the reason for the delay, we can't do that. So it would be, we can tell you which cases are over 60 days and even, which ones are the much longer over 60 days and try to go in and do file reviews and look at those cases, but that isn't entered.
And you can tell where they're from. So if we said we want to know how many are over 120 days because 60 days is a nice goal, but over 120 days, then you're talking about something somewhat unusual.
What we do when we get the reports is we have to look up each case and figure out why it's behind. And same with TPRs or anything else. You have to look up the individual case then. So it would, for us, it's not a lot of work, but for Multnomah County, it would be horrible. Unless they're keeping statistics.
Maybe. Although I have to say, our cases are not by and large being that delayed by criminal prosecutions.
Yeah, I don't
think so either. In large part, it's because we've had cases where, we've got an allegation of a criminal misconduct, there's a criminal charge pending, and if they really want a trial, we'll amend the petition and simply say, you've been indicted, you're not a custodial resource until that's resolved, and that's the only allegation we'll try. And maybe it is an issue of training with the other DAs around the state. But there's some easy solutions short of a legislative change that I think we can deal with.
If I had to say when the ones we've looked up, the most significant delay has been over finding all these dads. That causes more delay than anything. Mm-hmm. And I'm also, you saw the Court of Appeals case that came out this week about whether that's what the effect of that's going to be. The Court of Appeals ruled this week that the court can't take jurisdiction when one parent admits and the other parent doesn't. And
finally.
Yeah.
Well, it is in some counties.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Krista.
Yeah, Multnomah has a form and they have a
findings regarding one parent as opposed to...
I believe that's one of five that does it that way.
Ah.
But that means you don't have jurisdiction until you've got jurisdiction.
But you have the ability to order services to the person who has made admissions.
Right.
I mean, in that particular case...
It should only if they consent, knowing that they don't have to.
Yeah.
Right. The person who already made admissions.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You don't have jurisdiction. Yeah, it's jurisdiction. Just temporary. You still only have temporary. And I think that's where the rub has been. People have said, well, Mom admitted, so we're going to do an order, and then you end up with two... orders. You got the one that was done in 2013 when Mom admitted and you ordered her to do all these things, and then you finally found, then Dad finally got his criminal case done and you adjudicated on him, and then you got two orders floating out there in the Court of Appeals that says that's what's wrong.
So what if we added, I'm going to try to circle back to where I started, that do not delay jurisdiction due to criminal proceedings do not automatically add that word in there.
But you've got does not automatically constitute good cause.
Yeah.
And then I really like the idea of maybe we need to talk about it more, but I'm an old prosecutor, and I think that performance standards, they get all bristly because they think you're imposing on their discretion, but performance standards are not doing that. They're setting out what somebody that does this kind of work needs to know. Yeah.
And we did, I was on the committee with Nancy Shop to with the parents and kids attorney standards, and then there was an effort if we would have like a DOJ DA standards, and with the roles being different, I did, you know, we did reach out to ODAA and didn't get much of a response. And again, I think because it's, you've got 36 different jurisdictions, mm-hmm. there, similar to, you know, the parents attorneys and kids attorneys all across the state. DOJ kind of runs by the ABA standards, which we were fine with kind of taking a look at to potentially put into a Oregon version of that. And again, but it has the same, you know, the caseload should be ridiculously small, and you should be doing all these things, you know, that aren't accurate. But so that was kind of going to be like a phase two after we were done with the other.
Well, and there is a mechanism for enforcing them, and that's right now all these, every county is that I'm aware of anyway, has some kind of a contractual arrangement with DOJ. And so
not almost, like 12 or 13 don't, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, either DOJ is doing the whole thing, or they're splitting, or the DA is doing it. Are there anywhere the DA is doing everything still?
No, because we do the middle.
Right, you do the middle.
So they're either DOJ is doing it, or they're splitting. So if you required performance standards to, as part of those agreements, that would be a good way to get it done.
The agreements are to receive a supplemental
right.
amount of money to us help assist.
Yeah,
there's no real teeth to it. It's just more of a agreement. But I think 11 or 12 counties don't sign it, and they still appear and do the cases. They just don't sign the agreement.
Well, in my experience in talking to some of the other DAs that are doing juvenile work around the state is, while I think you will have trouble getting 36 elected DAs to all agree on performance standards,
anything.
I think that if there were some proposed best practice standards, that I think your line DAs would be happy to see what those are, mm-hmm. and what people would like to see them do. I mean, as you all know, you get some younger DAs thrown in there. They're not always given a lot of direction. And I think some recommended standards might be a way to get some more compliance, as opposed to trying to get 36 electeds to sign off on something.
And the Oregon State Bar standards actually are, there is a whole preamble that really makes them aspirational in many ways. Mm-hmm. You know, they are the best practice, and there is a recognition that adhering to them 100% in every single case is not always practical or advisable. So, you know, while they are, I think the Oregon State Bar is very committed to keeping that kind of preamble language, and that when we look toward the day when we really can start doing this multidisciplinary trainings, it's going to be critical, because it's really hard to be able to help shape people's expectations of what they're supposed to do and what they're supposed to see from the other side when there's no document to look back to. I think we're all very rule-based, and so even if they're aspirational to some degree, it's helpful to have something.
Madam Chair, chairperson, whatever the proper term here is, it's one of the things that's frustrating about this process is there's a bunch of stuff in all of this, mm-hmm. and all of it has some merit, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the issue is sort of, how many lists do we have? Now, this is sort of substantive, but I'm meaning, okay, what's legislation and what's best practices for judges, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. You know, and then some other things. If we could maybe even start sorting that way, so we can figure out what this group can accomplish, mm-hmm. in the time we have. It's just a thought. It just seems like so much of it is more in the best practice.
And I think that goes with what Bill's saying. Maybe what we better do right now is sort out anything that we think is legislative and focus on that. Because if we don't, we're going to miss the deadline, and we're not going to produce anything legislative. So, and maybe that's fine. Maybe we end up deciding that it really all belongs somewhere else. But maybe what we ought to do right now is go through and indicate which ones we think involves legislation, and focus on those right now, and then we can look at the others as we have time. And the first one was this, we've got that one, and then we've got the appointing attorneys at shelter care issue that's come in all of these. Is that something that we need to address legislatively? Because that would end the practices where it's different with other things. I don't know. You know, right now it's up to the discretion of what.
Doesn't seem like the rest of the appointment is. That's not statutorily contained, right? I mean, the regular appointment process is not how attorneys are appointed and when. It's not.
You know, that's a good question. I think about it. I always. Is it in the?
It's in 419.
419B150.
Right.
I think.
Yeah.
But that could be interpreted
the
way it's
to
written.
Court-appointed counsel.
Right. Right.
Certain conditions
doesn't say
for both
when.
Parents and
but,
children.
But that could be interpreted with training to say this can include shelter hearings and should include shelter hearings. You don't necessarily need a new statute.
Or, well, you're going right. to, I think, the you know, this has been discussed by judges for a long, long time. And the judges that don't do it are just, they think it's going to hold up the process. It's a delay issue. They want to get in. And it is, you know, you think so?
No, I'm sorry, Judge, to interrupt. I also think some of them think it's a real docketing issue.
Yeah.
So they don't have time in their schedules every single day to be able to have the extra time to get the court-appointed attorney appointed and to get them there. And
Viola, if it were required, the judge wouldn't have to do anything.
Right.
It would just happen. It would be done, you know, there would be a list or whatever, and it would get done. So, you know, I appreciate, I know what you're talking about.
Well, I agree, too. I think that the ones that are not doing it are not going to change unless somebody tells them you must change. And,
It's going to be legislative, though, I think you have to be a little careful how you word that. We had a prelim yesterday, and we're a large county. We have a lot of attorneys floating around, where one of our attorneys who was picking up a dad, and the dad we think's in federal prison we're trying to locate, wasn't available for the hearing. So we've got a second shelter hearing scheduled, but we went ahead and did the hearing anyway. So you don't want to be limited that when you can't actually get a body in the courtroom,
you
can't do the hearing, because then you're in violation of the 24-hour statute. So I think we'd have to be careful, particularly in the smaller counties. I can envision scenarios where there's a day you can't get three lawyers in a courtroom.
Well, we really struggle with it. We are very, very under-lawyered. I think our county is one of the worst ones for that because of the volume that we do as opposed to population and number of lawyers, and that has to do with the weirdness of geography and various whatever. We are constantly searching for lawyers, but the way we do it is we have them appear by video and by phone, and we get them from other counties, and when you have to do it, you have to do it. And we frequently have shelter care hearings with a judge from Pendleton on the video, you know, because we don't have a judge. For example, there's no judge there today. If we had a shelter care hearing come up today, we would have to put the call out and see if somebody somewhere, and we just keep widening the circles, and you know, and until you find somebody. And if worse comes to worse, I might be sitting in the Portland airport today doing a shelter care hearing at 3 o'clock over the phone. And so you just do what you got to do. And we used to never have attorneys at shelter care hearings. Then Judge Irogoyen, for some reason, drank the Kool-Aid and decided that we had to have them. And when the presiding judge just says, you got to do it, you got to do it. And it changed everything. Mm-hmm. And so I would certainly go out and prophesize to other judges that it's a better process. Despite the logistical things, it gets better outcomes. Because I think now about all those poor schlubs that came in for the shelter care hearings and just everybody looked at them, they took your kids, bye, we'll see you later, go see an attorney. And that was pretty much what the hearing involved. There was no discussion of anything else. It was just, you know, go away and see your attorney and come back. And it's an entirely different process now. So
I was just looking. So 419B195 is the statute that we're talking about. And it does, I mean, I'd have to look at it more closely, but it does seem like, I mean, judges can rely on this to appoint pre-shelter.
Right, which they do.
So knowing how hard it is to get legislation through and to get people to agree and have issues raised that you don't necessarily want to go down that path. I mean, if there is a statute that's workable that could get you that same result, maybe it falls under the training and not a legislation.
Well, one thing that could be done is we could, as a strategy, decide to focus through education and training for judges on that, on trying to change the practice, then look in another two years at that list again, because the majority are doing it, are appointing before shelter, and see if it's been significantly reduced, and if it hasn't, then look at legislation.
And yeah, I'm sorry, when I said 195, that's for the child or ward. Sorry. So I was trying to find with the 205 is the appointment of counsel for parent or legal guardian.
Another item on this list is under changes that don't cost money, established applications of trials for I always feel sorry for whoever the chief judge of the Supreme Court is, because if they come in with any aspirations, they will soon have their hearts broken.
It's the ultimate hurting cat.
Nobody, including the chief justice, can tell me how to do my job. And it's tough. It's hard. So my guess is that all you do, all that would happen if you did something like this, is that the cranky ones would get madder and people would ignore it. I mean, how do you enforce it? I mean, Bill is smiling.
Do we know how many counties set aside a time every day that if there are shelter hearings, it will occur then, and how many it's just, like Judge Sullivan says, there's a kid taken into care? Because, again, I'm really curious about the scope of the problem. If you have a county, for example, that sets aside a time every day, but they don't have to use it. I mean, Multnomah, we use it every day. But they only have to use it twice a week or something. I mean, one thing to do is through the contracts for the providers is require the lawyers and pay them enough to hold open that time every day.
I think that's
so that they can appear. And it would be, so if we could get more courts to agree that there's a certain time of day that they're held, if they're to be held that day, and could get contractors to agree, not necessarily the person who's going to pick up, but even a courtesy person from the consortium or from other providers to be available that day. I mean, at least you get the sort of MPD model of somebody standing next to you when you're arraigned and saying, you know, someone will talk to you soon, don't talk. I mean, that seems to be a step in the right direction, having a person who you can trust, sort of, if you're the parent, giving you some advice and saying, don't lose heart, you will have a lawyer who is experienced and who will walk you through this process. And if we had the cooperation of both the courts to set the time aside and the providers to set time aside, maybe we could get a little farther.
I think my experience, just from hearing anecdotally, the counties I've appeared in, and anecdotally, is that there majority have a set time for shelters.
Yes.
But I think the problem, like Polk County, the one that we're appearing in now more often, they have 2 to 3 shelters a month, and they're held at 4 o'clock every day. So to have someone to hold open 4 o'clock for a month when there's maybe going to be 2 or 3 would be tricky.
Right. We used to have on Fridays, we'd only schedule one courtroom, so we had the other judge kind of available for everything that had accumulated over the week that we could put in and the other. But the shelter cares don't occur like that. We could go 3 or 4 weeks without having one and then have 3 in 1 week. So I think the smaller counties, there's nothing you can do about it, but the bigger ones.
And certainly
I would say that the expectation under the contract is that lawyers are there, and we've had a variety of experiences in terms of trying to solve the problem in a jurisdiction where they aren't there. And so sometimes they are scheduled at a consistent time each day, but it's the same time that the provider who's also providing representation in criminal cases is expected to be in a criminal courtroom. And so it's not only having the docket at a consistent time, it's having the docket at a consistent time that doesn't conflict with another place that the lawyer has to be. I think that's one of the most common things we see, and then that, you know, that creates a whole shifting within that jurisdiction. And then, you know, it's a much bigger conversation for everyone in the jurisdiction. But that is what's required. If we're in counties where you have contractors who are providing representation in multiple case types, which is absolutely necessary in those smaller jurisdictions, you can't survive on 3 appointments mm-hmm. per month. You have to have a mixed caseload, and so the dockets simply cannot conflict with each other, and that's a big hurdle.
On the other hand, in a smaller county, you know, if you've only got 2 courtrooms and a shelter care comes up, then it's easy to stop. I mean, it's the same judge in the same place, and you just...
Right. If there's willingness, if there's willingness on the court side, then it doesn't need to be a problem.
Well, and I guess maybe that's the judicial training thing. In a county where this is given the utmost and highest priority, then it isn't a problem. Where people resent it and say, you know, we don't want to send the jury home an hour early today because we got to do a shelter care, then it's going to be a problem.
Having spent a significant amount of time in 2 different counties in the state and seeing how this situation affects cases, but also the challenges it proposes for attorneys, it's really interesting because everything that all of you have said has been a barrier either in one or the other counties and resistance for some of the very same reasons with the consortiums. Lynn County currently has, I think, been one of the last counties to come on board with having attorneys at shelter. And I've been there for nearly 5 years, and I have listened to our presiding judge try to work that situation out with the consortium with very little success until he finally said it is now an expectation. And within the last 3 weeks, they're managing to figure it out. And what a difference it's already made in the outcome and the parents' ability to have a voice.
Now that is one that makes me think of a way you could do this without legislation. You could do it by PJ order. And that
I was going to ask about that because it's my impression that those are about as common as asteroids. So, you know, are there a lot of Supreme Courts?
I mean, CJOs, Chief Justice Orders? I think it's something that we could definitely talk to the chief about. I know this has come up in many conversations with him in the past, and to see if he's willing to. And I do think it has changed a lot. I remember back in 96, 97, it was rare to have an attorney in a shelter hearing, you know, outside of Multnomah County. It was rare. They just weren't there, and now the majority are. So it is something that we're constantly
I think what happened about 96 is Tim Travis went around and educated people, and a bunch of people heard the call, and that's when the big change was, and that's exactly what caused it, was going to each county and saying, this is the best practice, and this is why, and then there's the possibility of an individual one for each county, too. I mean, you know, like you said, when the judge finally just said, we're not going to do it, this is the way, then it finally happens. But it would, you know, if it was a Chief Justice's order, that would be, and you wouldn't have to do legislation on it. And I think it's clear under the statute, so it doesn't require a statutory change to do it.
But I do think it just requires a little extra push somewhere to get everybody to do it. Mm-hmm. So. Okay, so we've crossed out.
We're going to take that off as a legislative change and figure out some other ways to work it.
Right. Okay, and then the next one we had is the for legislative about.
With the UTC on.
Let's see.
docketing.
Docketing. That'd be a legislative one. Oh, the pending, yeah. That's what we started with. So let's go to that one next about, is that something we want to look at a legislative fix on, too?
Which one?
About the cases pending.
Press it. I thought we said no.
So we crossed that out.
Okay. So then what's the next one?
We just dealt with we sort of, the educational requirements, I don't know that that's going to go very far.
And that wasn't legislation. That was like a CJO.
Oh, right.
The other legislative only thing on this one was the attorneys for DHS.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking.
And that's also on
funding.
The attorney standards. And
now, I assume that DHS, Lois isn't here, that they're going to propose that anyway. So maybe that's not one we need to do because the agencies, they already had one this last time.
Yeah, there was House Bill 4156, which was the temporary fix, allowing caseworkers to appear without legal representation.
Right, which is not what we want. We want just the opposite.
Which sunsets. And then I think the push now is what's going to happen, and it's a big budget issue, of course, for everybody.
Do we know what they're going to do? Are they going to propose legislation, or are they hoping we will?
Well, I think you probably have more of an update on what's going on than I do.
Yeah, there's ongoing meetings, kind of, I think, to discuss that, and I think DHS is in the middle of looking at, you know, what it would take, what the ask would be for that. You know, this has been tried in the past and has failed numerous times. so it's, is there a way, excuse me, is there a way to get that information and really back it up, and now we've been appearing in certain counties. Is there a way to use those statistics to assist legislatures in seeing the benefit to that? I think those are discussions that DHS is having internally, and then we'll be bringing it up.
Well, my feeling is that it would be easier for us to support whatever DHS decides to do and put it in our recommendations, but not be the flag bearer. But I don't know.
Yeah, and I think at the last bill, I mean, DOJ put on the record that they were interested in this being the sunset and be a temporary fix. Mm-hmm. I think OJD did the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think DHS is, you know, it's a lot to accomplish in that short amount of time. So I think they're internally trying to figure that out about what realistically they can do and come up with and have to the legislature. And I think they have a report due in September. So I think they're taking these months to figure that out, and hopefully we'll all know much sooner than later, but in the next couple of months, I think, what the intent is, whether to seek that budget request from the legislature to be fully represented, or if there's some other option that they're looking at. I don't know.
Rather deeply embedded in the whole attorney discussion is there as an element of it.
So, yeah, I do think it would be their proposal, probably, or a joint one or something. So having the support of the group, I think, would be helpful.
Well, do we have consensus in that we should support whatever they decide to do, unless it's continued the no representation? Because we don't.
Well, and it seems like we should, as a group, support full funding for representation for all parties. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to have a policy option package that would help our attorneys reach some level of parity, you know, which will help us control caseloads. One of the biggest problems we have is the inability to control caseload due to the low rates that are set. We'll be pursuing that through a policy option package, but I don't know if this group wants to consider legislation that would support both, and whether or not there's something that would be appropriate.
Let's talk about that, because that would be a broader So what you're talking about is legislation that would include funding?
Improving the quality.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem, is that DHS doesn't have legal representation. We're not talking about improving the quality of it. It's just we're talking about getting them legal representation. And then, you know, being able to, and I get that issue, and I think that that issue is important, but I think it shouldn't kind of merge together and have, it's a distinction, and I think I don't want it to be lost that we're talking about the same thing when it's not. And I think, you know, some legislatures, it's a lot to kind of know what goes on in these cases and who's appointed when and who represents who, and
right.
And there's confusion about that all over the state.
Right, though we do have jurisdictions where we still don't have providers at the initial shelter, and so it mm-hmm. seems to me that something along the lines of full representation at every stage of the proceeding would be an appropriate goal.
Yeah, I think maybe it would just need to be parsed out so it's not, I mean, it's, or that could be the overreaching goal, and how do you achieve that? Will you achieve that with fine-tuning? We're almost there appointment-wise for the parents' attorneys, not quite. We need to make sure that we get them, but we're able to under the statute. It's just, then it becomes a money issue about parity and standards and being able to show that people can make a living at doing this work and have it be important. And then I think the other side would be, I don't know if it's 50% of the hearings where DHS is completely unrepresented, including
it's a funding issue too, Joanne.
Yeah.
I mean, really,
yeah.
It's not a question of, there's no statutory prohibition. In fact, there's a requirement that DHS be represented. So
mm-hmm.
when it really comes down to it, there's not enough money, or the state hasn't chosen to put its money into making sure that all the different parties who are attempting to reach the proper resolution, thanks to the judge, who hears from all these represented people, are funded. And so, I mean, I don't think that distinction about you don't have anybody and we do, or we have better, you know, have a better break than you do, is not going to, I mean, I think we either have to decide that we're not going to take a position as a group on any individual's request for money in order for representation, or that we're going to agree that, you know, the elephant's in the middle of the room, that we're going to all, and what I wrote on the last page of the one that's got a bunch of bullets, which is really hard, and no page numbers, sorry, is seek full funding for representation of all parties, state, DHS, parents and children,
uh-huh.
so that gets the DA and DHS in there, parents and children at every critical phase of the juvenile dependency proceeding. I mean, to me, that's, it may not be perfect, but that uh-huh. encapsulates what we would all like to have happen, and I don't think we can start agreeing that we're going to support somebody's thing we haven't seen yet, or
right.
not, or support one but not the other. If we can just have a principle
yeah.
idea that we're either going to support that, or that it's
yeah.
too bold and we can't support that, and everybody should go off and pursue their own.
Well, if you go to page 3 of the the one that's on the form, there's 3 bullets there, the judicial resources, funding for attorneys, and funding for a performance measure. That could be all lumped into either a recommendation to the legislature or something, because that actually picks up, we've been talking about attorneys, which I think is probably the most acute need, but we also identified the lack of judicial resources and the lack of any kind of objective data, which they've listed, people that did this page. And it does match some of the ones on.
Mm-hmm. Nancy, can I ask a question?
Because I've been kind of thinking about the difference between, you know, having attorneys and improving the quality of representation of attorneys. And currently, do you have the resources? You said there are some counties where there aren't attorneys at shelter hearings, but do you have the resources in those counties if the practice changed to have attorneys at shelter hearings?
Not right now. Not under our current contract.
Okay. So the contract looks different if the county has attorneys at shelter hearings?
No, the expectations are all the same. So
I mean, it's the
expectation is there. we expect lawyers to be there at every phase, and I wouldn't even say critical phase. We expect them to be there at every phase. But, you know, I'll take YRJ as an example. The lawyers at YRJ are willing to make substantially less than their counterparts in order to be at shelter hearings. We don't
willing
compel. What's that?
I said willing might be a little too. Grudgingly willing.
Right.
Dedicated.
Yeah, it isn't just the shelter hearings. It's that they're not making any money.
TDMs, yeah. FDMs. It's all the phases. And so,
You know, and I've got attorneys that would do it if they were just making enough that they made some money. They're losing. You know, I've had attorneys quit because they couldn't. They were private attorneys out in Eastern Oregon. You know, you're not going to have it. And they're willing to do it because they believe in the work, but they couldn't do it at less than what their overhead was, so that they were actually losing money in it.
Right. When we met with our Eastern providers, one of the big issues was that my understanding is that at some point in time, mileage to do client visits was covered under the contract, and at some point in time, years ago, it was removed. And so they now have to pay it out of the contract rate, and they could literally eat up the entire contract rate if they visited their client three or four times.
Yeah.
And so where is the incentive then to visit? And, of course, we're saying you must visit, but for them it becomes a matter of economics and keeping their doors open. So in this next...
And especially if there wasn't enough attorneys, because you had to have five attorneys in Mount here, and so you're in LeGrand, how are you going to pay for that?
Right. So we are putting in a policy option package request in our next budget that will include mileage for attorneys in Eastern Oregon. But, you know, there are financial barriers. So, you know, I hate to point it out, but if both state lawyers and defense lawyers were all willing to agree to the same amount of compensation, we could control the problem.
Yeah.
But it's that is a dynamic that we will never be able to.
The gap is so huge. I think, you know, when Washington, what did they say, they were paying 75 to 95 an hour?
I don't remember.
And even Idaho is paying more an hour. I think they're paying for their public defenders. I was trying to, I could find out, but I know they're paying more than Oregon, even in Idaho. And I mean, that's kind of like, whoa. You know, when I get bills for private attorneys in my community that are doing, say, domestic relations, and they're charging $200 an hour, and we're paying these guys, what, $35 now?
Well, under our contracts, it's different than the hourly rate. Our hourly rate is still $45 per hour, and luckily, we have been able to convert the majority of our providers into contracts, which is a flat rate schedule, so it's not hourly. We only have about 2.5% of our representation right now under hourly agreements. And with the flat rate, the level of compensation is it differs radically around the state, because in a county where there are more review hearings, the provider will actually have more opportunity for payment.
Right.
In a jurisdiction where there are fewer, they have fewer opportunities for payment. So we're trying to switch that in our pilot program to where we're funding a caseload instead of hearings, because the hearing really shouldn't be the trigger for compensation. We expect representation throughout.
Same with CRBs. You used to not pay on those, and then you did, and so then the lawyers all went. So, you know, I mean,
right, it's a compensation issue.
Judge, since 1987, my first session here, the first issue I ever dealt with was injured defense. And I remember Senator Thorne from your neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
He had a real bug in his ear about injured defense, and he used to complain about five or six attorneys in the room. The legislature is faced at every session with hundreds of equity issues.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about the Washington State study is it ties equity into results.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whatever you do here, you're going to have to show that adequately compensating attorneys, and one of the challenges in this area is not so much not only increasing pay, but making sure that the people who are getting paid more do better.
Mm-hmm.
It results in savings for the state, both in the short and the long run. I wonder sometimes if what Washington State did was a pilot project.
Right.
And I know it's not just the defense, the family side, your side that has issues about adequacy of representation, mm-hmm. but the state as well. And I just wonder sometimes if you put a pilot project together with all those components in there and then measure the results.
This.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and that is what we've ended up doing. We are collaborating with both the courts and with DOJ on our pilot project. So we're picking counties where DOJ will have representation. Mm-hmm. And so our goal actually is to come up with sort of, for lack of a better term, the perfect model that we can then take out around the state.
Would you be able to do that better with funding from the legislature to do
that? And we're asking to fund two new counties. We'll be asking to fund Multnomah and Clackamas counties. Right now, we're looking at funding for our first counties, Lynn and Yamhill. So those are smaller counties. That's sort of what we can afford this time around. So we'd like to look at some bigger counties for next time around. But, you know, we're trying to focus right now on getting these two launched so that we have the ability to really make a strong request in the next legislative session. And, of course, we would love this group's support for that.
So are those are the determined counties, or those that's where you think you're heading?
I think that's where we're heading.
Seems to me
I think we're
that,
very close, but, you know.
You know, with the attorneys at shelter care, that's where you could really demonstrate that. If you had kids going home faster, if you, you know, because then as soon as you do that, then you demonstrate the cost savings for foster care, which is the big.
Right.
You know.
Well, and we're looking at the statistics, and we have a many, many counties where the average length of stay is around 22 months, it looks like.
Yeah.
That's a really long time. If we can get that down.
If you're 2 years old, it's half your life.
Yes. If you or your whole life, almost 22
almost
months.
Almost your whole life.
Yeah.
If we can get that down to 12 months, I mean, that would be that would be wonderful. And
the cost savings on that would easily pay for any attorneys.
Are those two counties that have long lengths of stay?
Longer. I don't remember what yours is off the top of my head. I think it might be 22. I think it's hovering around 22, 23.
And you've got cooperative judges in both those counties, so that makes a difference, too, in terms of... Well, what could this group do that would help that process? Because I think Bill's exactly right. I think when you can go to the legislature and say, you know, we did this pilot, we did this, and it resulted in this, and it will save you a whole bunch of money if you'll implement it. They're going to listen. If you just go in there and say kids need help, they'll be real sympathetic, but nothing's going to come out.
Right.
The program that has been funded hasn't started yet.
Right.
And that's what the young lady here to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not going to see any data from that before the next session.
We won't have data, but we will have anecdotal discussion. And I think the contractors in that jurisdiction are aware of the fact that they can bring on lawyers. If they're part of this program, they can bring on lawyers, and then they will have an easier time being at those shelter hearings and meeting all their other obligations. So.
And, Bill, don't you think that it's important that the legislature knows they're doing that so that you lay the groundwork for when you come back with the...
Yes.
Yeah.
And you need to be able to measure it, too. And it needs both for the state, and then you talked the last time about having Plan B judges. So you put more judges with familiarity in this area in those courts, too. But too often we half-starve the system. I mean, our way in the legislature is, rather than adequately fund one thing, what we do is inadequately fund a dozen things.
Right.
And, you know, and what you get is poor results across the board. So.
And there is... there is the possibility that there might be some other there's definitely other technical assistance that could be available too, maybe through the National Association of Juvenile and Family Court Judges and things like that.
Yes, and so we will be working with DOJ and the courts to make sure that we're providing the multidisciplinary training for the providers in these pilot counties, so that we really do get the results that we're looking for.
First one that they got in their strategy. So the strategy C, I would like to see us do something with that. Because I think it pulls what we've just talked about. But maybe what we ought to do now is take a break. So.
It's funny because I'm on their daily email list.
No, I think we have to schedule it when you're waiting for anything.
Because they have a special for the day and it's like $5. I saw it last night and I'm like, oh. But she's not going to get up and be here by 7.
Yeah, I can't remember where she is.
That's going to be here. Let's get started again. The first thing I wanted to start with before we move on is Bill was telling me something right when we ended, and I wanted him to go ahead and share that with the group.
People may remember about 4 or 5 years ago, Representative Krieger and then Judge Brewer, now Justice Brewer, put together a small work group to work in dependency areas because of some of the problems the Court of Appeals had seen. And the offshoot of that was one of the things was the additional counsel, the panel that you have of appellate attorneys that do nothing but juvenile work. And I think we've already seen positive results about that. And Representative Krieger came to me and asked if they put that group back together, whether my office could assist. And I ran it up the flagpole and said, yes, we could, which I knew the answer would be yes anyway. So he has an interest in this area. I know Justice Brewer does. And at some point, it may be worthwhile to invite the two of them when you've come to a more concise idea of what you would like to do.
And Representative Krieger actually came to our first meeting, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
But to continue the conversation with him on this and invite him again, and maybe have a conversation with Justice Brewer, because one of the things that happens in this process is reports due by this group to the legislature no later than January 15th. Well, no one goes to jail if it's a few days later, whatever. We have meetings in December, and then we have a meeting in January. I mean, there's one thing you would need to work out with the chairs of the committee. The beauty of December is it's right before session. The beauty of January is you're going to have the actual committee that's going to be here on the bills.
Right.
So that's something to work out. But they would be a perfect segue from what this task force is doing into the legislative process, because it always helps to have a committed member or members who are familiar with what you're doing and will champion what you're going to do.
Okay, so I think we should try to invite them to our next meeting, maybe?
Sure. Okay. When is the next meeting, Madam Chair?
That we need to talk about, because I think we had it scheduled for August. Is that right? And
don't remember.
We have Eyes of the Child going.
I have it on my calendar for July 11th.
July 11th.
Do people have that down?
Oh, that would be right, because
we were supposed to meet in May.
We were supposed to meet in May and didn't, so it's July 11th.
Huh?
And then the next one would be September. Maybe the September one would be better to invite them.
I will not be a July 11th.
Yeah.
Nephew's getting married in Connecticut.
Okay, well, let's invite them for the September one. And then we'll talk about the July meeting, depending on what we decide we want to do here.
What was the September date?
Sorry? I have September 5.
Okay.
Is that not that's necessarily correct.
That's Labor Day weekend, right? Or is that the weekend?
No, it's after. Labor Day's the 1st. For some reason, I showed on September 12th, and I don't know why. But that may just be my calendaring issue.
I thought it was the 12th because we didn't want to do it the first week. But I'm not sure. I don't know. I can't answer the calendar.
Fridays, unless it changed for some reason.
What do you have?
I don't know that I have it in there.
I mean, it doesn't matter my schedule. My schedule is fine either of those Fridays.
I have it for the 12th.
You do?
Yeah.
12th of September.
Which would be right before legislative days.
Okay, so would that be better than the 5th?
I'll tell you then, I guess. I can't, hard to say right now. You know.
What do we think? I didn't pay, that was when I was supposed to be in trial. I'm not now, so I can do whatever.
What day is Labor Day?
Labor Day is the 1st.
Anybody have any strong preference one way or the other?
Later one.
All right. The 12th. We'll go with the 12th and we'll invite them. And now we'll come back to the July meeting in a minute. We've got to figure out what we're going to do next. It looks like we don't have any consensus on any legislation, at least right now, although we definitely feel that we should be involved in some that may be coming down the pike with other people. Let's go to the one here that has the bullets, which is the barriers, the training. And on that one, yeah, that one seems to me it's real close to something that could be written up in a report or a series of recommendations to the legislature. Was there anything in that one that jumped out and grabbed people, like the issue with the pictures to the kids, that we need to really discuss because we're not in agreement on? The performance standards, we've already discussed that we may want to call them best practice standards.
Everybody's highlighted.
Yeah.
At the very end, there's some stuff that's highlighted.
Are those possible legislative changes?
No, those were funding issues.
Funding issues.
Yeah. The maximum caseload standards.
The caseload standards.
Could be statute.
Right, that's right. I mean, I think that all of them up to where we get the highlighting are, they may require some funding for us to implement these better trainings and more trainings and involving more people and all that, but they're much more general. And these other ones, I did my best.
But it's very compact. It's all about what, having good people representing folks and doing their job, classes, judges, etc.
It's well organized by who. And okay, so I think what we need to discuss.
There was something here I had a concern about on this one.
Okay.
And it was the highlighted one on the very last page, which is extending the sunset. And that it has or allow the sunset to the exception for DHS representation. And from the judicial side, I think, as was said earlier, we were pretty strong on the record that that we saw this as a short-term relief of the agency of having representation at all hearings and didn't want that sunset to be extended.
I don't know who wrote this. My job was was Scrivener,
mm-hmm.
and putting everything in together, and so I didn't take anything out. We did get a comment from DHS saying they preferred not to have this one in, the either or. And so maybe that's between you and they. I left it in because I didn't know who put it in the first place.
Yeah, I didn't either, and I thought this was the time we would maybe be fine-tuning it. So
yeah.
I didn't have a...
Well, if nobody wants it in, let's get rid of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that what's captured above is full funding for representation of all, which I sort of drafted to, okay, that's easy enough.
And on that one, I again would propose that we take out the word critical, because I think that then there's an argument about, well, is a TDM critical? Is an FDM critical? And I think our position is it's all
every phase
critical, so let's just...
I agree.
Thank you.
I agree.
then the compensation one is highlighted too.
And I, you know, honestly, I think that's, although we put it in there, if the full funding, I mean, it can be incorporated into what does full funding mean in the one above. It can be separate because it expresses a principle that has to do with equity both for the providers and for the parties. I mean, so.
What do you think on...
I guess we should leave it for now, huh? Yeah.
I have a question about funding for legal consultation for CASAs.
They're a...
You didn't...
Okay. An egg?
Yeah.
I think that came from another person. That wasn't me. But I don't... My thought is that that is not a state funding issue. That is a CASA funding issue.
That was
and
my thought,
one that
too.
We should...
take that one out.
Okay. And I think initially it was put in here so that it was definitely a need that we've realized on occasion is needed for CASA, but I think it's our goal and it's not the goal of this group. So I hope that's what that is.
And you don't have money with your pilot to do an evaluation, like to hire Portland State or NPC Research or somebody to do?
I don't know. When we talked last, we talked about doing a study.
No, yeah. I was just wondering if there's no funding for it.
Discreetly built in. It wasn't. It was really built to reduce caseloads originally, and I think we're expanding it beyond that.
I think it's critical that you get an evaluator.
I agree.
I agree.
I mean, I think we'll make it happen one way or another.
Well, and this is Joanne's language, which I totally appreciate, and I think it probably comes from the idea that the pilots have grown from just the OPDS pilot to including DOJ and DHS, so there's probably additional funding needed to address that bigger pilot.
And and I think it just stems from, and we've all seen it, I'm sure, it's just there's a pilot, and then it either just keeps going forever, or it eventually drops off, and then there's another pilot somewhere else. And then, you know, like, I think we had legal representation of the agency in Linn County in 2004, and that was a pilot, and then that went away. You know, I mean, so for me, it just seems... You know, it's deja vu all over again sometimes, and that if there's a way to capture, you know, what are we accomplishing by this pilot, and is there a metric, and is there something that we can demonstrate, like Bill said, to the legislature, like what are we getting out of these pilots that we can use? And I think you're going to get some good stuff out of yours, and to be able to just be able to have the skilled person be able to interpret those statistics. Same with, you know, with DHS representation in Lane County right now and Polk County. I mean, I'm one of the people like trying to think of, well, what would the legislature want to see as a result, and how can I help capture that? But I'm not fully trained in those areas, and I would appreciate, you know, other assistance. And so kind of that's why I think I suggested that language, but I don't know if that was part of the pilot or if DHS is willing to do that as part of their pilot.
We were planning primarily on relying on existing statistics with the hope of one day having a full large evaluation.
It. Yeah.
And certainly initially we're going to have to rely on things like length of stay. And.
So maybe it's an aspirational goal, maybe it's an internal goal, just for a, you know, or maybe you determine.
The legislature would want to include in any funding package for substantive work, some kind of evaluation, so it probably makes sense to stay in there. I mean, Bill can tell us whether that's the case or not, but...
No, I think it's really important, and I just want to know if you're putting it in your POP or if it's going to go in some other person's POP to make sure that that happens. And it sounds like it's more than just the PDSC pilot, but it's also the piece with the agency representation.
Viola, when you mentioned POP, it says to me, budget item, ways and means discussion only. I would try to write something up that also would get you before a policy committee like the Judiciary Committee. This is more important than just a budget discussion, so just a thought. So, and that would be maybe by drafting language that creates a pilot program, whatever, however you determine those to be. What would be included in the pilot program and then the evaluation part?
That sounds like a good idea.
That sounds really good.
Maybe that answers our what we should be asking the legislature to do is set up the pilot and fund it. Correct evaluation.
That's the question becomes, what's the difference between what the office is doing and the larger one in turn? You know, do you really want a single evaluation that looks at all of the elements? Rather than, you know, whatever gets built in here and sort of scramble around to figure out what you would measure independently, say, in terms of DHS having more, you know, like legal representation. It just seems like it belongs in a package rather than in fragments.
Right.
You know? No, it does.
And that's why I like the under C under here, because it picks up all of them. Increasing judicial resources, the attorneys, everything, like, you know, pretrial conferences, for example, somebody to measure whether those have an effect or not.
Did you? If I might, I had a question. Bill, would you envision some kind of bill that would create a pilot program and also have a task force component that might reconvene the Judge Brewer and legislators and members of this group into some type of oversight committee? Or how would you, I know, because you've mentioned both of these things separately.
Chair, members of the committee, my first reaction would be at the beginning of the bill is to write in the policy statement, okay? If you'll notice in this task force, the job of staffing it went to the legislative staff, and the beauty of that is you avoid budget costs, okay? So that's always the issue with the task force, who's going to pay for it. Legislature and the committee, Judiciary Committee, or any committee for that matter, can easily create a task force on its own. So, but you could. One of the things Judge was talking here, you know, when we talk about evaluating the counties where you have the program, you may also want to evaluate the counties where you don't.
Right.
And because that's considered the gold standard.
Right.
So, you know, the first thing would be to write a policy statement of the number, you know, kids in dependency care, on how this, a successful result for them reduces cost to the state, both of us to results in successful, more likely successful lives, reduces the cost of the welfare system, the criminal justice, and juvenile system, and then go on to describe each element of what the project would be. Now, you would want that to go to a policy committee. It would mean it would go to Ways and Means afterwards, but you've started the discussion along the policy lines, not just solely a budget issue.
Okay. Thank you.
So would we see the pilot then being what we had kind of talked about before is creating, you know, like the ideal counties where there's full representation for DHS, full representation and the ability for attorneys to meet certain standards? Is that kind of what we're seeing as the pilot? So it's in addition to what you've already started, but adding in the DHS piece and really, you know, making sure it happens and making sure that.
And I think that was part of when Nancy invited us to sit with the, you know, that it's their pilot, but, you know, opening it up to other partners. And then DHS agreeing, you know, DHS has received no funding to join in to this pilot. But so it's coming out of their budget, which means they're cutting other places to do it. But they were, I think, willing to do it with one. I don't know how many. I don't know
where
it comes
to. We just have two right now.
Okay.
And you were already in Lynn.
Yes. Well,
assuming
at the time, right. And so, I think DHS was looking how to do at least one county, and maybe, I don't know, depending on the size, to join in with that. And then I think you would, and again, from DOJ's perspective, I would think you'd want to measure it as a whole to show how successful it can be when all parts are running as they should, with court, you know, involvement, and not just involvement, but, you know, really dedication to that process, and OJD being a part of that pilot in that county too. Without DHS here, I don't know how far along they've gotten.
But what they're contributing DHS is paying for lawyers. They're not making a change in their practices. Is really focused on representation, or
yeah.
are they? Is
I
there
think,
some other thing that they're proposing to do?
Well, I think that there are going to be changes in some of the practice,
depending
only on
the counties.
Or so, yeah. Well, yes. I mean, using Lynn as an example. When we went to Lynn County, we learned that discovery isn't provided until about 3 weeks into the case. So that's something where DHS, I don't know if that's a funding issue, but there are going to have to be practice changes. That
all around the court process, not around... I mean, I'm just trying to sort of keep the integrity of what we're measuring,
right.
And if it starts being they're implementing differential response, or they've got a new family preservation program, then we start...
Right. We committed to not going to counties where there's already some other program running.
Okay.
Yes.
And differential response was implemented a few days ago, a week ago, in Lane County and in Klamath and Lake. And there are no other dates yet for implementation for other counties.
And then is there involvement in terms of change in practice or additional funding for either the district attorney's office or the judicial branch in those two counties, if it's an overall pilot?
Changes in practice, or I didn't hear the second one.
If there's additional resources, because this is a resource, what we're measuring is the impact of additional resources, which are presumed to create better practices. So I'm just curious if we're now gone from just the attorneys for parents and children to attorneys for parents and children and the DOJ, does this bigger picture involve the DA's office and the judicial branch?
DA's office is not involved in Lynn County, correct?
Even at the initial?
They are now?
They are.
Okay.
Well, Judge Murphy was one of the judges that pointed out the statute, or enforced the statute, to say he wasn't going to allow DHS to appear at any hearing without their own attorney, even if the DA appeared. Then, with this legislation that passed, the House Bill, the 4156 that passed, that temporary fix, Judge Murphy has agreed that either the state up to jurisdiction can appear alongside DHS, or if there's certain hearings, DHS can be unrepresented. But DOJ is appearing at shelter hearings, because the DA does not appear at shelter hearings in Lynn. So we do the shelter, then we step out, and the DA does jurisdiction and steps out, and then we step in or out, depending on the middle, and then we come in again at the end. That's currently Lynn. Right.
Without regard to the specific question, it seems to me that more judges, more judicial officers is, frankly, every bit as important as the other element that's been discussed
yep.
here. In so many ways, the problems, and I learned this really when I was plan Bing it and sitting in other jurisdictions besides Montana County, but this issue of I can't fix anything about the way we do stuff because we are so it's just a big traffic jam, and even in adult criminal stuff, I mean it's universal problem, and at least some start, whether it's a pilot project that goes along with the office's pilot project that says there needs to be, in a county with X population, there need to be this many people doing juvenile dependency work, per square inch, whatever it is, some kind of a formula that looks at that. Because if they're adequate, Portland, you know, there's constant problems with scheduling because you've got four or five lawyers, you know, everybody's represented. But the issue is they've already got hearings. You know, it's just, it's a monumental problem. But if you don't have any significant, you know, commitment to docket, adequate docket time, there's no hope. There's no hope.
Right, and even in Multnomah County, where we have a number of family law judges, they're all doing dependency work, but they're also all doing family law cases. Some of them are doing probate cases. Some of them are they're all doing the VRO docket. I mean, they are not dedicated to our dependency docket. And, you know, we have had termination cases that take 5 months to try because you get 4 days here, and then you get a day this month, and then 3 weeks later you get a day, and then, you know, 2 months later you get two more days. Mm-hmm. And that's in nobody's best interest.
And then we run into a little bit of a different problem where it would be lovely to have more judicial resources, but we have the same attorneys representing parents and children, and so even if you have a second judge available, they're there to help, you can't, there's always one attorney that has to be in the other courtroom, right. So you can't have cases going on simultaneously, so the lack of adequate amount of attorneys prohibitive
and
for
the
us
other,
scheduling
other thing
for us.
We've been pushing is the one judge, one family, and if you have different judges stepping in doing all different stages of the proceedings, it's not the best practice.
So under C on the courts and docketing one, I had included, and I think I mentioned this briefly at the last time, that funding's needed to contract with, and I mentioned these two organizations because they've done these kinds of workload studies in the past, National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges and the National Center for State Courts, to do a juvenile court workload assessment. And the last time the Judicial Department did a workload assessment, it was in 1999, and we know that things have changed greatly in juvenile law since that time. And what the National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges has been doing recently is they've put together a model of not only looking at, you know, these are the number of resources you have, so this is where the resources should go, but also looking at national best practices and standards for how the court should be handling these cases. And looking at where your courts are now in doing, in meeting these expectations, so what do you really need to do it accurately? So that's something that could maybe fit into a pilot, mm-hmm. of getting that done soon within the time of the pilot. And
I have a question about that, because mm-hmm. it seems to me that we could do that for all of the, you know, the parties and the judge, but it seems to me that the DHS and the parents and children's attorneys have been able to be persuasive without spending the upfront money for someone else to study us and say we have a problem, but have been able to identify it. And I would frankly rather go straight to the, we know it's a problem, give us more judge time.
Well, the
give
issue us more. Is what do you well, ask for?
Yeah,
you
know? And where do you ask for it? And
it's just, it seems to be a two-stage. In other words, if we were going to draft something for this session and we're asking for increased party representation resources and study of judicial resources, we're a, you know, a biennium away from increased judicial resources. It's just a question of whether we think we have sufficient information ourselves to be able to make the case for additional judicial resources now with the others. Don't ask me, I'm not the chair.
Madam Chair, one of possible solutions would be Plan B judges that are Plan B'd out, allow them to come back that have specialties in this area, because it mm-hmm. is a pilot project. Mm-hmm. The legislature may be reluctant to create a judicial position for a mm-hmm. pilot project that a year or two down the road, mm-hmm. 3 years down the road, may not be there. And also, you've got an area that's very detailed, and you need to have some experience in it, too.
Yeah. Quick and dirty. What about finding, is it possible, Leola? No, I hate to ask, because the system, all the system stuff is, I'm too old. I absolutely refuse to comprehend any of it, you know, with all your problems with getting data and so forth because...
How to see a new board and new computers and old computers.
But couldn't we come up with some kind of a simple sort of common sense formula? There are this many children in this county, or there are this many kids in care, you know, some number, and how many how many FTE judicial officers are there in that county, just to see what it looks like. And then, you know, say anybody that's below average should be brought up in something to start with. I'm just wondering if I mean, I agree with Angela. It would be a shame not to start addressing this.
And because there are lots of variables in how courts calendar and schedule cases and whether or not you have judges who are fully assigned to juvenile or it's split apart amongst several judges.
Or you don't have any courtroom, so it wouldn't matter if they gave you another judge.
So it makes it challenging. Sure, I can put together some numbers to prove whatever you would like me to prove.
I like I the design of this is the best decisions in individual cases, because every case is different, are made by well-trained, smart, hard-working people presenting both sides in a smart, well-trained person with enough time to make the decision. And it doesn't make any sense to me to fund the smart, well-trained people to talk to a judge who doesn't have time, or not to get in front of a judge at all. So it just seems to me it's the, you know, this is the
right.
The model, and we ought to go after it. And if it means that we say in these two counties, here's the money for the presiding judge to hire a referee, or in these two counties, here's a plan to, I don't know what you meant about plan B'd out. You mean people have already done their time as a plan B? Are you plan B'd out? So, you know, bringing back people
they
with
may
the expertise.
Have plenty of plan B that aren't, too. You know,
right. But looking for the expertise
right
in but if that's sort of stealing from Peter to pay Paul, we're already using all those plan Bs. Something that says, in these counties, we're putting in some more judicial time. Temporarily, not, you know, it's not an elected, we're not giving you another judge, X county. We're giving you temporary use of time.
Yes, and I think that we could certainly do that with looking at individual pilot counties that we've identified and come up with a rational, reasonable explanation for why additional judicial resources may or may not be needed in that county. And my hope is that this kind of model will continue and expand in the future, and at that point, I do think it's judicial resources, and I think that having an outside entity come in and look at everything that's happening and evaluate what's happening and make a recommendation on what those judicial resources might be would be helpful.
So
we could do both,
yeah.
Probably
right.
Within this umbrella of pilot.
And for what it's worth, I think my perspective is that a juvenile time study essentially to determine how many judges are really necessary is critical. I think that the mental hurdle I keep running into is how to fit it in with the pilot, which is sort of already up and running. And if you're measuring, it seems like the two are really distinct. I mean, maybe you are measuring in the pilot how much time does it take in terms of judicial resources, and you're using that as the standard. But it seems like two different studies to me. Does that mean?
Well, there's a big one and there's the pilot ones.
Yeah, I don't see this as being part of the same evaluation.
No.
Okay.
I see it as being a separate component of a pilot project.
You know, the old problem with Oregonians, they have to invent everything themselves. Do we know that there isn't anybody in the country that's figured out how many juvenile court judges there need to be?
To do a good job.
Center for state courts or something, can we find out whether there's anything out there that might be usable?
can certainly look. I was recently looking at the Washington State study to see if there was anything that we might be able to pick up from there, because they have implemented the parent representation program. And but with changes of laws and differences between laws within the states and just structures within judicial, within courts, it was a little challenge and something I probably needed to sit down and put my head around for a while to come up with something. but it's certainly worth a look.
I was just involved. I won't go into a lot of detail on setting up a program that has nothing to do with juvenile, believe it or not. And the data to support what we were trying to do is non-existent nationally, non-existent locally. And so one of the people on that task force put together a formula based on, you know, pulling things out of here, there, other states, what they were doing in this public outreach issue. And we came up with a number. I mean, it was the hokiest thing you can imagine. Plug your ears. Or turn your machines off there for a minute.
Take these things
out. Don't tell anybody I said this. Well, it's just hokey. Legislature bought.
What did we buy?
I mean, and nobody said that it was a brilliant or, you know, incisive, but it was something that said this is what the demand for this service is. It's better than nothing.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we need to figure out, it sounds to me like what we've got is that we want to put together a recommendation for a pilot, and then what do we want to do with the additional recommendations that we've got here that are to all different entities and not just the legislature? Do we want to formalize that in some kind of just a report to the legislature that then would go out to all the various other entities?
Are there organizations of each of the groups we represent that if we took this and sort of slimmed it down, that we could get sign off from each of those entities, which seems like then it would be very powerful before we even presented it to the legislature? I mean, I don't know what it would be, like you're us or it's OCDLA or I don't know what it is, probably OPDS. Yeah. District Attorneys Association, probably DOJ itself. There's a statewide CASA organization. I don't know about the judges. From everything. The Judicial Department.
Right. Best practices.
Yeah. I mean, if we could take this and sort of take the things and put it into one two-pager at most, back and front.
That's what the systems mapping one, which we haven't talked about yet, kind of came out to be. It's just a list of best practices.
Yeah. But I think we have the system mapping, and then we have the training and education, which is could be smaller, and the oversight and standards. Those are all things
maybe
that make
pages.
Us better.
Maybe 3 pages.
Tiny font.
Tiny font. I didn't work very hard on this round at all, and I would be very happy to do a portion of that or all of it. I have probably more time than anybody else does to just pull it together and make lists, and I promise you, you'll have it in 2 weeks. How's that?
You're hired.
Fun.
Yeah.
Oh.
We have nominated. Second.
And that means we should have the July meeting, because then we could get it out to the associations, which are all meeting in August and through October, you know, various things. But we'd have it, for example, for...
And actually, in addition to the OD, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Multnomah County also has a Child Welfare Council that may or may not be willing to lend some support if we get a draft. I don't know what the other counties have, but maybe there's some.
All of the courts have model court teams.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And DHS is actually distinct from DOJ.
Yeah.
In my mind.
Yeah.
So that would be a category, too.
Absolutely. Oh, I think they will sign up.
So this is a document that would include recommended best practices that can be done now.
That don't cost money.
That don't cost money.
Right. Well, theoretically.
Yeah.
theoretically. That we're going to pay for ourselves, basically. We're not asking the legislature for money. They're definitely going to cost money.
Right. But can be due with existing resources.
And then, you know, what we could do, we could probably steal a little bit of time at model court day to get by off there. Mm-hmm. Because I could see my model court team, for example, looking at that and saying, okay, you know, we're doing this one, this one, this one. We're not doing this one, this one, this one. We're going to commit to doing that.
We are in the process of planning the Juvenile Law Training Academy. That could be another place to share.
Yeah, that's a real good one.
Chair, one thing to think about, too, would actually start the rough drafting process.
Yeah.
If you're moving towards a pilot project. And since Nancy's already thinking a lot about this, you may want to assign her the task of starting the rough drafting process. Okay.
Can you do that?
What a good idea.
For the pilot?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So we need a policy statement and then an organizational thing. Can we do that by July? Those two things?
So when you're talking about a rough draft for the pilot project, we are already starting a document. You know, we already have a document, essentially, that is outlining ours. Mm-hmm. And then we're just going to add in the components of the other parties. And so we'll share that with everyone as we...
And I would say make it what you'd really like to do if you had a little bit more money. So if you'd really rather have four counties or whatever it is, you know.
Too large, too small.
Yeah. Right.
Smaller.
Make it what you'd really do if it was if you weren't just trying to shoestring it.
And I know that Lynn and Yamhill are probably considered smaller counties, but I don't really think they're considered rural counties. Mm-hmm. So,
Yamhill is kind of Yamhill's rural.
You know the challenge. We looked at rural, and the challenge is simply getting there.
Yeah.
And getting lawyers.
She'd love to do mine, but it's such a hassle.
I would love to do it. For us, it's going to be a harder nut to crack because of the remoteness. There are so many obstacles that are just centered around the remote nature. So my suggestion, for what it's worth, is that we start in some counties that are accessible. Clatsop is another county where we would love to do something. But there are we run into the problem of fewer service providers, fewer lawyers. We just need more time, I think, to develop our resources in that area to do the kind of recruitment that we would need to do. It's just going to take more attention. I love the idea, and I want to get there. I'm not sure it's attainable in 2 years.
So our marching orders for the next meeting, Judge Welch and Nancy Cosine are going to get those two things put together, and I think that's enough for that. Then we're going to invite the Representative Krieger and Judge Brewer for September, when we will hopefully have something really to put together to present to them about the task force. And then I realized that there's an area that we may have been remiss in ignoring. And the reason it's on my mind is I just got back from the National Association of Drug Court Professionals Conference, and I'm in the process of changing my women's adult drug court to a family drug court. And we have not discussed family drug courts at all in that model. And one of the things that I spent a whole lot of time doing was hearing research presentations on, and there's been huge amounts of evaluation and reports on statistically on family drug courts, and a lot of people don't even know what they are, but we do have several in Oregon that are in existence. And nationwide, family drug courts have proved spectacularly successful in two areas that are probably of interest to us. One is dealing with the worst of the worst, the families that are intractable, where you have repeat terminations, repeat removals, serious issues that suck up all the air out of the system, that burn everybody out, that you have terrible results. Surprisingly enough, the family drug courts show the best results with that group as opposed to the easier people, which is really exciting. And they are, most family drug courts that have been in existence for a while are in the process of shifting so that they're taking that group, which are the high-risk, high-needs people, which is what's happened in adult drug courts, if you know anything about them. The best results statistically surprised everybody. They're not the ones that sail right through. It's the ones that, if your goal is to repeat, is to stop recidivism, is to lower the number of days of kids in foster care, for those kind of goals, if you work with the worst of the worst, you're going to get the best results and you're going to show the best cost savings, which is really exciting. And hearing that, you know, is kind of mind-blowing. And then the second thing is that they have some really interesting things to say about where you put the money, because if you, with adult ones, it's prison days. With juvenile ones, it's kids in foster care, which is so expensive. And the, they've done some really interesting studies that show that the dollars you put in for family courts cost X number of dollars per client versus what it costs in the regular system, and you can achieve substantial cost savings by putting your resources into a family court model. The reason for that probably is because you're talking about intense judicial involvement, and they found that the best is that they see a judge every 2 weeks, and less than that doesn't work. More than that can work in the first month. So a lot of them see them every week during the first month when they're going in. The same judge, and the optimal size is about 30 participants in a family court. So they're small with the same judge, lots of intense involvement, and then intense wraparound resources. So you're throwing everything in them and really making a go of it, which is kind of what we've been saying here, that the piecemeal approach of just putting a little bit of Band-Aid on everything just keeps the system kind of going. And what family courts have shown empirically is if you really put the effort in on these real high-risk ones, you can see the best results. And the people that they see the best results from, I know these because I'm translating this into who we're going to put into our court, are people that have serious substance abuse problems, have domestic violence overlays, have criminal records, have persistent long-term maladjustment in terms of employment and housing. Now, that's really something if you're talking about that group of people. Yeah, that's what they statistically are seeing the best results. So we haven't looked at the family court model or whether we want to look at that or make any recommendations with that, or how the Oregon ones that are in existence are doing. They have plugged along with different funding sources because most of them have been grant funded, and so they've had really different experience with funding than the regular system, because they've been able to pour a lot of resources in because they've had SAMHSA grants and things like that. Now we're doing ours with, we have no funding for ours, so I'll let you know how that goes. But we haven't had any grant funding since 2004. We run all of our drug courts without any grant funding, which is interesting. But anyway, we haven't talked about family court, so I just wanted to throw that out there, that maybe in September you might want to have a presentation about those two, or if you want to take the time, or if that just goes in a direction that maybe is fine the way it is and it's out there as a best practice model and we want to work on the overall system and not look at that.
My reaction is that we need to stay on task in terms of, because it is nice to see how much consensus there is in the room now that we've kind of gotten down to the real brass tacks. So what we need is...
Well, and that's what I'm kind of thinking, you know, and I wanted to throw it out there so you were aware of it, but it may be that the next step in this is, okay, now that we identify this, what are the models that we might be able to look at, and that's a different task than what we were assigned with. So I'm perfectly fine with that. I just wanted to make you guess.
We had a program, I don't know if it still exists or not, Lori, in Portland that started about 10 years ago that involved, it was very complicated and it was very resource rich. Of offering mamas in patient drug treatment day one with their kids, with them. And the success of that was astonishing.
Those
astonishing. The numbers were just... Is that still going?
Well, we still have, is that when the FIT team started that you're talking about? With a, we have the family involvement team who will meet with a parent at prelim, will schedule a drug and alcohol evaluation within a day or two, has outreach workers available to get them there, will find them if they need inpatient. I mean, we've had women go into inpatient within less than a week. And some of those we've been able to either immediately or within a couple of weeks put the babies in inpatient with them. I think the most motivated are usually the new moms where the babies are being born drug affected. But we've had some great success. And having the availability of people that are literally at the prelim that can walk outside and schedule their next appointment and arrange an outreach worker to take them to that appointment has been invaluable.
Maybe that's what our task really is here. We get the overall system cleaned up, then it's going to facilitate those kinds of things so much
better. Is that what, with attorneys being...
The attorneys are by and large, as long as their clients are coming in saying, yeah, I've got a problem, the attorneys are by and large not standing in the way of that because they know it's... You know, and if you get the new moms and the positive UAs at the hospital, the attorneys don't have much they're fighting about at that point. So, by and large, the attorneys are not standing in the way of that.
Then you save
all cross-trained, and they know about the programs. Then, and they're right there at shelter care. That's been my whole thing is let's get these moving. You know, when instead of sitting around arguing about whether somebody who showed up at the shelter care hearing high on meth and admitted it has a problem, let's get them into treatment right now.
I mean, I had a prelim yesterday where one of the outreach workers went and got mom and brought her to the prelim. So she could come to the prelim and meet with a FIT worker. So
that same model's been in Jackson County for at least, yeah. I'm going to say, maybe 15 years, and yeah. It does. It's incredible the difference when you get that upfront support.
But that's the model that everybody, I think, aspires to, is where they're so coordinated between their court system and everything else, and they really get everybody else there, so... Okay, so I think we're, anything else that we need to discuss what with any of this today, or we are at a stopping point?
Well, one other just nitpicky little detail. I think it would be nice to have a clear picture of what the meeting schedule is.
Yeah.
So July, we're meeting when?
18th, right?
11th.
That was 11th.
11th.
July 11th, right. September 12th.
July 11th and September 12th.
Which is good because those don't conflict with the August and October meetings that we have.
Maybe, could somebody send an email out, or I could, just to make sure everybody who's not here gets those dates firmly on the calendar.
Can we charge Leola with getting our dates and getting it out to everybody so that we're all clear and...
Just let me make sure I have them written down correctly. Okay. July 11th, September 12th.
And November?
I show November 14th, but...
14th, which should be right.
If we were on the every other month schedule.
November 14th?
Right. I'll volunteer Michael to do that for you, okay?
Thank
all right.
You.
Great.
Thank you.
You know I say volunteer everyone else.
Urgent.
Okay.
And, then and did we have a December meeting set, or...
No.
24th?
Yeah. Don't have consensus on that.
Well, I think our goal was that we wanted to be done by November so that we have a report to the legislature for those dates. So, bring anything else. Okay, and who is going to invite the representative and Justice Brewer?
For the September
meeting? For September.
I'll give Representative Brewer a call, too, but I think it would
tell
help.
Them. Tell them we're very amenable, and that's what we want to talk about is back again and part of that process, having somewhere to go with these recommendations that are not not necessarily involving any statutory changes. He usually comes to Eyes of a Child, too. So
excuse me?
Just as Brewer comes to Eyes of a Child. Yeah,
okay.
It, so.
Yep, we will be.
Okay.
Great.
All right. Good job, everybody.
Thank you.
This last draft of stuff is really looking good. I want to commend everybody for their work.